computing software on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, bombs in the trunks of taxis kill dozens in the heart of Bombay. Who is responsible?
In Argentina, military officers responsible for that country's dirty war may lose amnesty because of a new president.
He's taken a very firm stand on human rights. He's moved in to shake up the army, and he's also been replacing judges in the Supreme Court.
Also, his victims react to the murder of an imprisoned pedophile priest.
She said, if I didn't report this in the 1990s, I would not have been part of the chain reaction that has caused his death, and she felt partially responsible.
And the chairman of the Republican Party on the president's declining approval ratings.
These stories and more, coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Two explosions in Bombay have killed at least 40 people and injured more than 150 others. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the attacks in India's financial capital, as Veer Singh reports from New Delhi.
Indian television stations have flashed pictures of shattered glass and blood, with victims being taken to local hospitals. The blasts occurred during the busy lunch hour at a crowded market and at Bombay's best-known landmark, the Gateway of India, overlooking the Arabian Sea. Police say two cars were used in the strike. Pakistan, whom India has blamed in the past for such attacks, has condemned the incident as a terrorist act. The bombings come after an easing of tensions between India and Pakistan. The latest incident is the worst attack in Bombay since a series of bombings 10 years ago, which were linked to tensions between India's Hindus and Muslims. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
U.S. forces in Iraq have staged new raids in Saddam Hussein's hometown. Seven men were taken into custody, most believed to be responsible for recent attacks on Americans. U.S. troops also reported finding hundreds of cases of anti-aircraft shells and rocket-propelled grenades. In the holy city of Najaf, thousands of angry Shiite Muslims filled the streets today for the funerals of three men killed in a bomb attack that wounded a top cleric. An autopsy is to be performed today on the body of former Roman Catholic priest John Gagan, who died after being beaten and strangled in his prison cell by a fellow inmate. The Washington Post and Boston Globe quote a prison employee's union official as saying Gagan was bound and gagged by the inmate who followed Gagan into his cell, then jammed the door to keep guards from entering. From member station WBUR in Boston, Tony Randolph has more.
The Worcester County District Attorney's Office and the Massachusetts Department of Correction are investigating the circumstances around the death of former priest John Gagan. They're trying to figure out how he was strangled, apparently by another inmate, while serving his 9-to-10-year sentence. The 68-year-old Gagan was being held in protective custody, keeping him away from the general prison population. Officials say Joseph Druce, a convicted murderer who's serving a life sentence, will be charged in the case. Druce is described as a neo-Nazi who sent anthrax threats to attorneys with Jewish-sounding surnames shortly after the September 11th terrorist attacks. For NPR News, I'm Tony Randolph in Boston.
Dozens of demonstrators have gathered outside the state judicial building in Montgomery, Alabama today. They're determined to block any effort to remove a granite monument inscribed with the Ten Commandments from the building. Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 58 points at 9,290. The Nasdaq is off 12 at 1753. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, stocks have lost ground today in light trading. Yields on U.S. Treasury bonds have fallen slightly, but overall yields have risen sharply since mid-June, raising concern among some analysts that higher interest rates might short-circuit any economic recovery. The nation's housing market remains strong, though. Sales of existing homes hit a record high in the month of July, as NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
David LeRae, the chief economist with the National Association of Realtors, says July will probably go down as the peak month in the nation's housing boom. He says the 5% jump in existing home sales is tied directly to low mortgage rates.
Mortgage rates were the lowest in 50 years back in June. Since June, mortgage rates have risen. They've risen rather significantly, well over one full percentage point. So I do expect housing now to start to slow as we finish the year.
Sales of existing homes were strongest in the Northeast and in the South. Nationally, the median price of an existing home in July was more than $182,000. That's up 12% from the same month a year ago. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
Gasoline prices across the U.S. have risen sharply in recent days, up more than 15 cents a gallon on average nationwide in the past 2 weeks. That's the largest two-week jump in prices at the pump in 50 years. The average price per gallon was nearly $1.75. Industry analyst Trilby Lundberg says the recent blackout caused refineries in the east to shut down temporarily, and the pipeline rupture in Arizona also disrupted supplies, but she says she expects prices to decline in the coming weeks. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now. No one has yet taken responsibility for two powerful bombs that rocked Bombay, India today, killing at least 44 people and wounding 150 others. One blast took place at a crowded jewelry market, the other at the city's top tourist attraction. Eyewitnesses described grisly scenes of body parts strewn across the areas. We're joined on the line by Rahul Singh. He's former editor for the Indian Express. Rahul, welcome.
Nice to hear you.
Well, I know you are in Bombay or Mumbai, the official Indian name of the city. When did you first hear about the blast?
I live only about 5 minutes walk from the gateway of India, where one of the bombs exploded. And my domestic help walked in at about 1:30. He said there had been four bomb blasts, but it turned out to be that there were only two. His daughter, who was in school, the school was very close to one of the bomb blasts, and they had evacuated all the children.
We hear that initially phones were jammed across the country, and it was quite a scene of panic.
Yeah, you couldn't get through, and all the cell phones, I believe, were sort of jammed. Yeah, they were deliberately jammed. Communications became very difficult for some time.
Well, Rahul, tell us about the two places where the bombs blasted. One, the Gateway of India. A lot of people can picture this huge edifice that was built as a tribute, I guess, to a visiting British king. It's quite a tourist attraction.
I think King George the Fourth or the Fifth, when he landed by boat, this big gateway made of stone was erected to welcome him, and it's one of the chief tourist attractions of Bombay. And there's a parking lot for cars just in front of that, and just next to that is the Taj Mahal Hotel. There was a taxi there which had the bomb.
Well, and then the other bomb took place 5 minutes later in a jewelry market. Both are attended by a lot of tourists. Is there any sense of who was the target?
Well, I think the gateway was meant to be to target tourists and to say that, you know, tourists should not come to India. I think that was like has happened in many other tourist attacks all over the world. And the other one was in a very well-known, largely Hindu area, and it took place near a temple, a Hindu temple, and that's why there's a strong suspicion that it could be some fundamentalist Islamic organization which is behind this.
Well, in fact, it is just about the anniversary of a spate of bombings by Muslim extremists in revenge for a 1992 destruction of a mosque by a Hindu mob. And a government report on whether or not that site was originally Hindu or Muslim was just released. Is there speculation that this bombing is tied to that report?
No, the report, I think, was made public only this morning. I think it's not even appeared in the Indian papers yet. You know, lots of temples in the old days were destroyed to make way for mosques, as happens with every conqueror. So I don't think, I'm sure the Hindu parties will play a lot into this, but frankly, this is part of history. I think it's a shame that people have got so worked up about something like that.
Mm. Rahul, what is happening in the city now?
A lot of people are going home. They're leaving their offices. They've gone home because they feel a little uncertain. I rang up a travel agency and they said they're closing down because, you know, people are going home. There's a scare that there's a Hindu nationalist party called the Shiv Sena, and they're a very powerful, very militant, largely Hindu organization. There's a scare that they might create some trouble tomorrow.
Hmm. Well, Rahul, thank you.
Okay, welcome.
Rahul Singh, former editor for the Indian Express, speaking to us from Bombay, now called Mumbai.
In a prison billed as the safest in Massachusetts, former priest and convicted child molester John Gagan was strangled Saturday by a fellow inmate. Gagan was serving a 9-to-10-year sentence for one instance of sexual abuse of some 147 he's been accused of. Dozens of Gagan's alleged victims have been clients of Boston attorney Mitchell Garabedian. From a strictly workaday office, without any of the usual elegant refinements of lawyers negotiating multi-million-dollar settlements, Garabedian has for years passionately advocated for clients of alleged abuse by priests. He joins us now on the line to discuss the killing and the reaction of some of his clients and his own reactions. Welcome, Mitchell Garabedian.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me.
Mitchell, shock surely for you and your clients at John Gagan's death, but is there a common thread to how your clients have reacted emotionally to this?
There is a common thread, and that common thread is my clients are confused. They wish Father Gagan had served the rest of his time in jail so we would have time to reflect and maybe react to these horrible acts he's committed. And they wish that he would have been a participant in the two criminal cases that have possibly could have taken place in the future where he's a defendant. And they wish that the public would have been made aware of more of his horrible acts through those criminal cases, but they're not going to have that opportunity.
Mitchell, is there a feeling among any of your clients serves them right?
Well, a lot of my clients, all of my clients, are fragile. They don't trust anyone. Many of them are spiritually void. And some of them feel, well, now he's going to meet his maker. Now it's judgment day. I didn't particularly want him to die, but now it's time for him to meet his maker. At the other end of the spectrum, one woman even called me and told me that she felt guilty about his death, and she was crying profusely. She said, if I didn't report this in the 1990s, I would not have been part of the chain reaction that has caused his death, and she felt partially responsible.
Mitchell, do you think this could have any impact on people allegedly abused by priests who have not come forward yet?
Oh, that's a very good point, because many clients also feel eerie about this whole situation. They feel strange. I think each individual is going to have to handle this incident on his or her own terms and to decide to come forward or not. Individuals are still coming forward, but each individual is going to have to deal with this on his or her own terms, as they are with healing, the healing process.
You've been so deeply involved in this long before it was a big news story. What about you? How did it hit you when you heard this?
I was shocked. I was stunned. It was unsettling. I mean, I had to stop and think. I was wondering, my goodness, what are the facts and circumstances around this? Let's face it, a child molester in jail is a marked man, but a high-profile child molester such as Father Gagan is even further marked. But I never expected this.
Mitchell, just to finish up, all of this goes on, does it not? Tell us briefly as you can where your cases stand now.
Well, my 26 cases involving Father Gagan alone are in the discovery process. And since 1994, I've been collecting information with regard to Father Gagan and his supervisors. I don't think his death is going to harm my ability to prove cases against his supervisors. I've been collecting information, as I said, since 1994, almost 10 years.
Mitchell Garabedian, thank you very much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you, Bill.
Mitchell Garabedian is a Boston attorney who has advocated for many alleged victims of sexual abuse by Catholic priests.
The deaths of 8 firefighters in Oregon have devastated their hometowns, but also added to the debate over the safety of contract firefighters traveling to out-of-state fires. 95% of contract firefighters come from Oregon, many of them forestry workers switching to firefighting because of cutbacks in the timber industry. The 8 men killed Sunday were all under the age of 23 and worked for the Oregon-based First Strike Environmental. They were returning from fighting a forest fire in Boise, Idaho, when their van crashed head-on into a tractor trailer after attempting to pass another truck on a curve. Last year, 5 Oregon firefighters from another firm were also killed returning from a fire in Colorado. Well, joining us on the line is Vicki Miner. She's executive director of the Wildland Firefighter Foundation. Based in Boise, the group supports families of fallen firefighters. And Vicki, have you been in touch with the families of these 8 young men?
Not yet. It takes a little bit of time for all that to sink in, and we'll be getting a hold of them soon. I wanted to note one thing. When fatalities happen, whether it's one firefighter that dies or a cluster of them like this happened with 8, that in those firefighting tents at night, I don't know of anybody who doesn't climb into their tent at night, and it does traumatize the people in the field. They all feel it. They're all connected to those kids, and some fought side by side with those kids.
Yeah. Is there a sense also of concern about how they died? Because I know after the last accident last June when 5 were killed, the Department of Forestry in Oregon adopted new driving rules for contractors. So many are racing to the fire and exhausted when they come back. These young boys had been fighting that fire for 11 days straight. Is there a sense that there should be some more regulations about how they drive to and from these fires?
You know, it's hard to say. I don't know of anybody who doesn't go to the fires, and they're a long drive from everyone's home. It stretches everyone who works in forest fires, those drives are. I thought about that a lot last night about, I think it was just a freak accident. I know myself I've taken long trips like that on those back windy roads where you pass when you shouldn't. Mm. It's just a loss, and I think these drivers are young. I don't know what the solution is because it's forest fire and it's an emergency, and people are tired. I just don't think there's a blame to place on any system or anything that's wrong.
Is there some sense that maybe after 11 straight days on a fire line, that maybe there should be some allotted time for sleep, let's say, before they get in the car and head home? And paid sleep, by the way.
This fatality was a passing accident. I don't think it's a rest issue.
Yeah.
I just don't think there's issues here that can make this thing safer other than probably these companies hiring people to drive these firefighters back and forth. Because a sleep issue is, it's not about the sleep.
Yeah.
I would like to say that these contracted crews don't get the benefits that the government employees get. There's public safety officers benefits that government employees get that is like $258,000. These contracted crews only get workman's comp benefits, which are sometimes only $2,500. And that's some of the reason that we have this foundation in place is to step in and financially assist some of these families.
Well, Vicki, thank you.
You bet.
Vicki Miner, Executive Director of the Wildland Firefighter Foundation. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Revoking immunity for murder in Argentina, just ahead.
And later in the program, want job security? Try folk music.
There's more coming up, Here and Now. We'll be right back.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The Argentine Congress in the past few weeks has voted not to forgive, with the support of Argentina's president, Néstor Kirchner. The Argentine House and Senate voted to revoke amnesty laws that have protected hundreds of military officers accused of involvement in the country's dirty war of the 1970s. Human rights organizations say as many as 30,000 Argentinians disappeared then, many young, many tortured, raped before they were killed. Joining us on the line now from Buenos Aires is Newsweek correspondent Peter Hudson. Welcome, Peter.
Nice to see you.
Peter, catch us up a bit first. Who is Néstor Kirchner, and why has he seemed to turn a new page in Argentina?
Well, he's an interesting character. He won the election. He took office just recently in May, and he's been a bit of a surprise, I think, to everybody, not just outside the country, but even to Argentines. He comes from the far south of Argentina, a province called Santa Cruz, which is one of the most sparsely inhabited provinces in Argentina. It's got about 1% of the Argentine population. And he really won the election by default. He was running against the former president, Carlos Menem, and people were really voting against Carlos Menem rather than for Kirchner. And he's really, I think, surprised everybody.
What has he done?
Well, first thing he came in and did virtually on the day he was elected was to get rid of around 50 generals from the various arms of the armed forces. He said he wanted to bring in new faces to have a change of generation. There was also a feeling there that he wanted to get rid of any sort of people who might have been involved in human rights abuses during the military regime of the 70s. He's taken a very firm stand on human rights. He's moved in to shake up the army, and he's also been replacing judges in the Supreme Court.
Kirchner himself was arrested during the 1970s, was he not? How important has it been that he was interested in revoking these amnesty laws for getting them revoked in the Congress?
It's been absolutely crucial. I think the majority of the Argentine public is supporting him. Kirchner, with what he's been doing so far, has been getting amazing levels of popularity for an Argentine politician, at least, given that most Argentines were fairly heavily disillusioned with their politicians. And he's really pushed that agenda. But before he came in, nobody else was really interested. The previous president, Eduardo Duhalde, had really refused to get involved. The president before him, Fernando de la Rúa, had passed a motion which had forbidden the extradition of military officers for trial abroad. There's many courts, particularly in Spain, who are looking to extradite the military for their role in human rights abuses. And the president before him, Carlos Menem, had passed a number of laws basically giving anybody who had committed human rights abuses pardons and canceling any trials.
Yeah, I mean, this is dangerous stuff in Argentina, is it not? I mean, these laws giving amnesty to hundreds, even maybe more than 1,000 military officers were passed in the late 80s to avoid stirring up the military. How's the military reacting to this?
Military is obviously not happy, but times have changed. Just after the military coup, everybody was very, after democracy was restored after military government, everybody was nervous that the military would try and stage another coup. That really isn't a risk now. For a start, there's no real public support for it, or no support at all, in fact. For a second thing, after 10 years of democracy, slightly more now, the military had been severely weakened. They've had budget spending cuts. Operationally, they're not in a condition to stage coup again. They're sort of fuming about it, but there's not really a lot they can do.
Could members of the military go to prison who had seemed to slip the noose, if you will, for what they allegedly did during the 1970s?
It seems likely, but it's going to be a long haul. In a way, many of the laws that have just been passed by Kirchner through Congress as well are really not that firm. There's a big legal debate about whether, in fact, Congress can actually annul laws, which is what it's done. So that dispute's going to go to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court has shown until now little haste in dealing with these sort of things.
So this could drift for a long time.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, what about the economy? We, of course, have heard about Argentina's economic problems, but even that seems to be turning around a bit under Kirchner, yes?
That's right.
Argentina's economy had been shrinking, had been in recession or even depression for around 4 years until Kirchner took office. That's not entirely due to him. He was lucky. He took office at the right time, just as the economy was turning around. Even so, there's a lot of work to be done, and I don't think anybody expects Kirchner to be able to sort out the mess that the Argentine economy is in a hurry. There's over 50% of the population is living below the poverty line still.
How are Argentinians feeling? They're legendary for their capacity to get morose. It was once considered a country where there were more psychoanalysts per capita than any other country in the world. What's the mood there?
None of that's changed. This is a country of tango, which is very much about how great things were and how bad they are now. People are, I think, optimistic might be overstating it. People's mood has improved. If you look at opinion polls, when pollsters ask people what they think the future holds for them, the majority of people think that things are going to improve in the next year or so. But there's still, I think, so much work to be done. There's unemployment of around about 15%, and that doesn't include the millions of people who are on government handouts for being unemployed. There's massive poverty, and the economy is still fairly fragile. So I don't think anybody's expecting that we're going to be an economic miracle in the near future.
Peter Hudson, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for talking to me.
Peter Hudson is Newsweek correspondent in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the final report in the investigation of the Columbia space shuttle tragedy.
And physical exercise. Why is it that people are either addicted to it or hopeless couch potatoes?
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, George Bush is on track to shatter fundraising records, but according to the head of the Republican National Committee...
He's not campaigning, he's just doing some of these events. He'll campaign in due time. But his focus right now is on national security and creating jobs and improving our economy and making health care more affordable.
And folk stars are aging rather gracefully, while the rest of the music business is not.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dave Fatiff. American troops have captured a handful of men in a raid on Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit. Some of the men are suspected in attacks on U.S. soldiers. More from Lourdes Navarro in Baghdad.
American forces in Tikrit have detained two men suspected of being Saddam Hussein loyalists and five others believed responsible for attacks on American troops. More are still being sought in the area. The military believes those captured and those they are looking for are responsible for the resistance against U.S. forces. Meanwhile, U.S. troops south of Baghdad have discovered a large weapons cache. It contained 300 fuses and 70 bags of gunpowder stashed in five shipping containers. There were also 400 cases of anti-aircraft shells and 200 rocket-propelled grenade rounds. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
Officials now say 42 people have been killed, 150 others injured in bomb explosions in Bombay. The bombings occurred in a crowded jewelry market and at a historical landmark. So far, no claim of responsibility. Officials point out the violence comes the same day as the release of a long-anticipated archaeological report on a religious site in northern India claimed by both Hindus and Muslims. An autopsy is being performed today on the body of a former Massachusetts priest, John Gagan, who was murdered in his prison cell over the weekend. The Washington Post and the Boston Globe report that Gagan was bound, beaten, and strangled, allegedly, by another inmate. Civil rights advocates, including Massachusetts ACLU Director Carol Rose, are calling for an independent investigation.
When you realize that one in 37 Americans has a likelihood of spending some time in prison in their lifetime, I think it behooves all of us to know what's going on in our prison system. It's a question of fundamental justice and fairness. If our prison system lacks integrity, then our whole system of justice lacks integrity.
Gagan was one of the central figures in the clergy sexual abuse scandal that forced the resignation of Boston Cardinal Bernard Law. A Ten Commandments monument could be gone from Alabama's judicial building as soon as today, but not without a fight. Supporters of Justice Roy Moore plan to lock their hands and drop to their knees in hopes of keeping the monument where it is. Judge Moore has refused a court order to remove the monument and has been suspended with pay for defying that order. On Wall Street at this hour, the market is off. The Dow is down 63 at 92.86. NASDAQ off 12 at 17.53. The S&P 500 down 3, 989.88. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Polling numbers are out today, and there's some bad news for the White House. Newsweek reports that for the first time, more registered voters, 49%, would not like to see President Bush reelected next year. And in what the magazine calls the biggest shift of opinion, more voters think Democrats in Congress can better handle domestic issues such as the economy, Social Security, and health care better than the president. Last week, we spoke with Democratic Party head Terry McAuliffe about his party's challenges. Today, Ed Gillespie, chairman of the Republican National Committee, joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Hello.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. Well, is it as bad a day as some would think there in the White House because of these polls? The Newsweek poll is about the same as last week's Zogby poll, which showed only 45% of respondents want President Bush reelected. Your thoughts?
Well, this is exactly where we said we would be back in April. Matthew Dowd, who's the senior strategist on the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign, at the time was a consultant for the Republican National Committee and had advised Republicans to not be too excited about the astronomically high poll numbers that the president was experiencing back then, because we knew that over time gravity would bring them down. And that's where we are today. The president's numbers are right where they were back in about March and of last year before the Gulf War. And so we're not surprised by this at all. His numbers are better than were President Reagan and Clinton at the same point in the presidency, and they obviously went on to strong victories.
Yeah, but they didn't have unfinished business in a country like Iraq. We should say 54% of voters in the Newsweek poll approve of the way the president is handling the situation in Iraq. But that's down from a 74% approval rating, as you said, and 61% still believe the U.S. was right to take military action against Iraq. But that approval would seem tenuous, given what's happening in Iraq right now. Isn't it risky for the Republican Party to base a campaign on issues like Iraq if, in fact, the rebuilding effort continues to falter?
Robin, we can't be political in how we approach Iraq. We have to do what is in our national security interest and make sure that we're getting the mission accomplished. And I think you see that. We've seen a lot of bad news out of Iraq, and it's disconcerting, and it makes us sad when we see men and women in uniform and our servicemen lose their lives in the line of duty. But that duty is important, and the American people understand that. And we ought to also talk about the successful things that are going on there that are some of the reasons why we're being subject to such violence. There is a new currency in circulation in Iraq today. The schools are up and running, and we're moving toward a point where the Iraqi people themselves will be responsible for governing their own nation. And that will result in a stable Iraq, and that will help stabilize the Middle East, and that's in our U.S. national security interest.
Well, how is the party going to campaign? Because U.S. soldiers, British soldiers, U.N. workers are still being killed in Iraq. Will you, for instance, use pictures of Mr. Bush landing on the carrier Abraham Lincoln under a banner that says mission accomplished?
Well, we're going to talk about our policies. In Iraq, we have a policy that, as you noted, the American people continue to support in pretty big numbers. We're going to talk about our domestic agenda as well. President Bush and the Republicans in Congress have worked hard to create jobs, to rejuvenate our college and retirement savings funds, to reduce our dependence on foreign oil and bring down the cost of energy and make energy more reliable. We have an agenda to lower the cost of health care and make it more accessible and affordable, as well as to win the war against terror. So we're going to talk about all of these issues and our agenda and our positive vision and compare that and contrast that with, frankly, the Democrats' lack of an agenda and their constant stream of protest and pessimism.
Well, but how will you combat what Terry McAuliffe says will be the Democratic message, which is pretty much one word, jobs? I mean, if there is a recovery, but it's a jobless one and people are still out of work, what can a sitting president say to offset that?
Well, the bubble had burst by the time the president came into office, and so he inherited this slowing economy. And we've acted responsibly to fix that. There's more that we can do, and we're trying to do more. But if you look at what the president's agenda is versus what Democrats have done, you know, in the House of Representatives, the Democrats proposed a tax increase on the American people. That is not going to help us create jobs in this country. In the U.S. Senate, the Democrats proposed $1.9 trillion in new federal spending. That's only going to slow our economy. So I think the president's approach is the best one. People vote looking forward, not back, and we have an agenda to make things better, and the Democrats don't.
Well, right now, at least according to the polls, though, the biggest shift in opinion of the American people seems to be President Bush's handling of these non-terror domestic issues. Most voters think that Democrats will have a better approach to not just the economy and tax cuts, but health care, education, Social Security, the environment, energy. How do you offset that?
We just get our message out.
How do you do
like
that?
Today,
but how do you do that when there's bombings in Baghdad? And frankly, that's what the media wants to talk to the president about, even when he's across the country trying to talk about logging issues, for instance.
Right. Well, there's a time for everything, and the political season will soon enough be upon us. But I'm confident that once we engage in that and the American people engage and start to lock in on the choices that they're facing in the election of 2004, which in my estimation will be one of the biggest elections we've faced in a long, long time in this country, they're going to realize that the president and his agenda are the way to go in terms of making our quality of life more prosperous and securing our country.
Well, Ed Gillespie, again, chair of the Republican National Committee, what do you say of critics, though, who say the president is focused too much on other things and those other things are campaigns right now? With so many issues on the president's plate, the Middle East, Iraq, the economy, why is the president campaigning at all when there's no Republican opponent and we're in the primary season?
Well, the fact is what we've seen, Robin, in the past, over the past 6 months, is a constant, steady stream of very bitter and partisan and harsh attacks against the president. We need to have the resources necessary to respond when the time comes to get our message out. We also need to understand that the AFL-CIO, the largest union in the country, has said it will spend $50 million to defeat the president in the next election. And then a group of liberal democratic activists have come together and formed an organization, and they say they will spend $70 million to defeat the president in the next election. So that's $120 million right there, all geared toward defeating the president, all of it invisible money, none of it reported. And in addition to that, you've had Democrats have raised as much money to attack the president as the president has raised. So I think it's important that he get the resources necessary to respond. But he's not campaigning. He's just doing some of these events. He'll campaign in due time. But his focus right now is on national security and creating jobs and improving our economy and making health care more affordable and securing our homeland from the possibility of future terrorist threat.
Do you really think that the Democratic candidates are going to even come close to President Bush's fundraising capabilities, already on track for doubling his record-breaking money from the 2000 election campaign?
Well, Robin, all I can go by is the current pace. And the fact is, if you look, the president raised $34 million for the reelection in the last quarter, and the Democrats had raised $30 million. So that's not much of a difference, frankly, between what the Republican side has raised and what the Democratic side has raised. So, yeah, I suspect the playing field is going to be pretty even before it's all said and done.
Well, of course, the money raised by the Democrats is split between a lot of candidates. But
it's all one message, Robin. It's all one big attack on the president every single day.
Well, Ed Gillespie, thank you.
Thank you.
Ed Gillespie, chairman of the Republican National Committee, speaking to us from Washington, D.C.
Still to come, the music industry in general is hurting, but folk music is booming. We find out why.
You're listening to Here and Now.
For a kid growing up in Medford, Oregon, anywhere near the 68-acre Howard Farm, the ultimate dare for much of the past 50 years or so was to take your chances with Old Man Howard. Wesley Howard lived in an unpainted, falling-apart house on the farm, which had been left him by his parents. He was raised there and just never left. He never married, never got a phone. He just liked his privacy, and he seemed to particularly hate children. He'd pull out a shotgun and shoot rock salt at kids who strayed on his property or found their way onto it to break his windows with well-aimed golf balls. Then Wesley Howard died of a stroke last March at age 87. And a surprise, Wesley Howard was rich, very rich. And then a much greater surprise still, he'd left all his money, more than $11 million, to build a sports park on his farm for local children. Well, joining us on the line is Jack Gunluck, who knows firsthand about what it was like to be chased off Wesley Howard's property. And Jack, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Jack, you're 45 years old now, but take us back to your childhood for a moment and paint us a picture. What was the Howard Farm like?
The Howard Farm was an old house in the 60s. And pretty scary for the children that lived in the neighborhood.
So you'd have these occasional encounters with Wes Howard. What would happen?
Well, I had a friend of mine that lived on the other side of the property. And for kids, you wanted to make the best of the time, so you'd cut through other people's properties back then. He'd yell and scream and bring out a shotgun and pepper us if we were running across his field, just to keep us from downtrodding his crops. But every now and then, we'd get up enough gumption to try and make it across the field again.
What did he look like?
He was a short stature old man, always in blue jeans, always in a shirt, always out there working on his farm.
Well, how did you react when you first heard about his money and what he planned to do with it?
Well, it definitely took me by surprise. And what he was going to do with it even took me more surprised. It was pretty amazing.
You were shocked?
Yes. When they put in this sports park, the community will be a lot better with it.
Is there a lesson in there about how we all kind of judge people and often don't know what's really going on in somebody else's heart?
Well, that's the same adage as the book and its cover, isn't it?
Yeah. the book and its cover. You can't tell one from the other.
You can't.
Jack, I was intrigued. There was an auction of Wes Howard's property, and you were particularly interested in one item. Tell me about that.
Well, I was interested in getting one of his shotguns.
One of the guns he used to maybe shoot rock salt at you, huh?
Well, you know, in the Times, they said that it was a 410, but, you know, I never did quite get close enough to tell what size of a shotgun it was.
So did you get the gun?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
Most everything there went for pretty high price, and it was something that I didn't really want to pay that much for.
Well, Jack Gundlach, thanks very much for joining us on this story.
Well, thank you for talking with me, and we hope that more people do the same thing.
Jack Gundlach, who had a few encounters in his childhood with Wes Howard, the man who just left $11 million to build a sports park in Medford, Oregon.
Oh, man, look at my life. I'm a lot like you were.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
America is getting older. In 1970, the median age was 28.1 years old. Now, it's 35.3. We're all pretty much aware of this. The government knows it. The healthcare industry certainly knows it. So why doesn't the music industry know it? If anything, pop seems more youth-obsessed than ever and has the declining profits to prove it. The record business is 16% smaller than it was in 2000. And most experts believe its inability to attract older consumers is a major factor. But in the small music business substream of folk music, stars are allowed to age gracefully. And business is booming. Our folk critic, Scott Alaric, is here to talk about why folk seems to be aging so well. Hi, Scott.
Bill, great to be here.
Scott, it's not the graying of folk music, is it? There's
no.
Plenty of young people coming up in the folk music world.
There is, in fact, a bumper crop of young songwriters and traditional folk stars. But what's different is that they're not replacing the older stars. They're just bringing in new fans to the marketplace and making the whole fan base bigger. Because folk stars aren't expected to remain in this state of perpetual adolescence the way they are in the pop world. And here's what's crazy about this demographic obsession with youth. According to the last census, the median income for people in the pop industry's prize demographic, that 16 to 24-year-old group, is about $376 a week. Now, for the median age group, the average American age group, 36 to 44, it's $658 a week. Huh. So they're not just ignoring the majority of Americans as they get older, but they're moving away from where the money is.
They're moving away from where the money is. Well, what are these older folk artists singing about?
Well, Joan Baez is a perfect example of this phenomenon. For years, she tried to stay with the pop world and made some, frankly, kind of embarrassingly bad albums as she was sort of trying to be young enough and herself at the same time. But now she's completely embraced the folk subculture. She's with a very smart indie called Koch and making exactly the kind of music she wants to make. Just to give you an example, to really prove the point here, this is a snatch of what Joan Baez sounded like when she was 20.
Trees, they grow high. The leaves, they do grow green. Many's the time my true love I've seen. Many an hour I've watched him all alone. He's young, but he's daily growing.
Now, that was one of the most beautiful and important voices in the modern history of music. But that voice could never pull off this song written by middle-aged Iowa songwriter Greg Brown on Joan's new album, Dark Chords on a Big Guitar. This is not a song about first love's hot highs and lows, but the yearning for those quiet moments of real contentment that only lasting love can give.
I will take you with my children through the clover to the creek, where Orion's gone a-hunting through the fields our wishes seek, where we all can love each other like sugar in our tea. Sleeper, come and go with me.
So what are the themes? Is it about getting older, the midlife crisis? Yeah. Parts of your body that don't work as well anymore, what do they sing about?
Well, what a lot of the songwriters do is sort of take the basic templates of songs that they created when they were younger and just reconsider them at different times of life. It's almost a joke in the folk world how young songwriters wax and croon about how dark and angsty their lives are. In fact, there is a joke that, you know what the difference is between a songwriter and a puppy? And the answer is, after 6 weeks or so, a puppy will stop whining. Now, that's true in pop, of course, but what we rarely hear is how those things get reconciled as we mature and settle into families and begin to accept our lives for what they really are. Now, John Gorka is a great example of that kind of brooding urban folk pop songwriter who came up in the late 80s and early 90s. His writing has changed remarkably since he became a father a few years ago. On his new album, Old Future's Gone, notice how he transcends from his own sorrow to empathy here, seeing beyond his own experience to the world at large. You can literally hear him getting over himself.
Trouble and care, always there. Always there, trouble and care, never far away. Sorrow is the shadow of love, no doubt. The light goes on and the love goes out. It can hurt so bad you can't even shout. Trouble's never far away.
Who else now? Patty Larkin.
Well, now here's an artist who really is going right at some of the issues of aging on her album, Red Equals Luck. She's, again, somebody who's had about a 30-year career of continual productivity. And on her new album, she runs right at some of the issues of aging, capturing those conflicting emotions of regret and nostalgia. And she's kind enough not to reflect on it with just sentimentality, but she's reaching her own midlife with some properly expressed disgruntlement.
Something in folk music in its essence, as opposed to, say, rock music, that makes it possible for an artist to continue to grow and for an audience to grow with that artist?
I think the most important thing is that folk has a long tradition of not being an age-specific music. It's a music that has a commitment to being about all of life's experiences, so it doesn't isolate people that way. And I should say that all of these artists are picking up young fans. I was at the folk festival circuit this year, and there are more young fans coming into the music now than at any time I can remember since the 60s, and that's about as much as I can remember. So.
Is there an argument in this music that we get better as we get older?
Yeah, and I think there's also another thing that I haven't talked about here because it's a little uncomfortable to talk about. I don't want to disrespect the young songwriters at all. But, yeah, we do get better at our jobs as we get older, and that's true of songwriters, too. The great example here is a Texas songwriter, Tom Russell, who's now in his early 50s, and he's always been revered among other songwriters as a superb craftsman, a great architect of songs, and he's taking that knowledge, along with his 30 years of experience, and tackling some really tough subjects. Like here on from his new album, Modern Art, he writes a song about Mickey Mantle, and he peels back all the layers of legend and sentiment to look at what it is to die too young, as Mantle did, knowing that you squandered so much of your health and your promise. And this is about how he had wasted his gifts on alcohol and high times. And it's a wonderful portrait of a life ending too soon.
I don't miss the lights of Times Square. I don't miss Tuchel's bar. I miss my old man pitching baseballs near the shed in our backyard. I wish that he were still around to see these trophies on my shelf. If I'd have known I was gonna live this long, I'd taken better care of myself.
I think there's something for our whole culture to learn about this right now. Our whole, particularly our media culture, is so youth-obsessed right now, despite the fact that America is getting older. Television, magazines, newspapers all seem to be driven by this corporate idea that young people are easier to advertise to. And the music industry seems to have aggressively built into its marketplace a system of planned obsolescence into their customers. Not into their products, but their customers, over and over again. They spend millions drawing new customers in, and just when they get some real money to spend, drive them away. And folk, I think, remains so strong and is picking up so many fans of all ages today because it doesn't operate by demographics, but by the older, stronger curve of generations.
Scott Alaric, the very gracefully aging Scott Alaric, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks.
Today.
My pleasure to be here, Bob.
Here and Now's folk critic, Scott Alaric. For more information on the music he brought us, visit our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
The board investigating the Columbia Space Shuttle accident issues its final report.
And why is it when it comes to getting in shape, it seems people either can't stop or can't get started?
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.
Boston University, this is 1290 WRNI Providence, 1230 WXNI Westerly, and on the web at WRNI.org. WRNI, Rhode Island's NPR news station.